Our next speaker is Justin Blum. Justin is a hydrologist at the Minnesota Department of Health. Along with our previous speakers, Justin has been investigating groundwater flow through till and will be sharing some of his results and insights with us. He obtained his BA and MS from the University of California. And as someone who vacillates between being a lumper and a splitter, I'm ready to take some lessons from you, Justin. It's all yours.
All right.
You're going to take a minute.
Let's try this. All right. Now, we heard from the splitters this morning, with apologies. I was responsible for only a small portion of this study, but focused mostly on aquifer tests. And as far as from the perspective of groundwater flow and aquifer testing, leakage is definitely a lumped parameter. So, if you're a splitter, give it up. Sorry. From the hydraulics perspective, there's no way to break it out. And in particular, if you don't have obwells in the till, it's not happening. So for the first time, at least in my career, I had an opportunity to have perform tests that had a chance of having an effect on hydraulics in the till. And, of course, then I jumped at it. So with that, I'll begin. Hopefully this is the right button. Aha. So presentation topics. What I did at the Department of Health had that fit into the overall project? And then I can't resist, because leakage is such a important part of the flow system, yet in terms of what I've been able to figure out from talking to younger people and academics, both, is that a lot of basic hydrology and groundwater classes don't include much on leakage. For those who already mastered this, my apologies, but I'm going to dive into that rabbit hole for a little bit here. What are the conceptual models of the kinds of analysis methods that we typically use? What is this leakage factor? I heard this at a conference once, and I went, of course, I would have been drinking. I said, well, it's actually useful. And, of course, that was a conversation ender right there. And the inherent and some recent publications that you may not be aware of, what are the inherent limitations of pumping tests to actually describe the source of water, or to actually, what portion of the flow system are actually we detecting in a pumping test, and how does that characterize the source of water to the well, and which is something that is, I think, very, very important for, at least in my work from protecting drinking water, but I think it would have a general application with many people here. Then I'll get into the description and the results of four tests from four sites. There were multiple tests, more than four tests, because of all kinds of other issues. So selected tests, we'll just say that. And the comparison of test results and conclusions. So the USGS and the University of Iowa people that you heard earlier today, they took protosonic core, installed obwells in the water table, aquitard and aquifer, did slug testing, water chemistry, and monitored water levels with transducers on a half hour to a 15 minute interval for over a year period at each one of these sites. Or I shouldn't say each one, but most three of the four sites. And then they had three of the sites actually were public water supplies, where the pumping wells, and so they had limited collection of the pumping rates or pumping volumes from those sites. And then they did modular modeling. So what did I do? Well, I was kind of late to the party, as usual. Of course, the health department had been informed about this study and that this was going on, and then they said, oh, we're getting ready to seal the wells. Anybody interested in doing aquifer tests? You know, what? Data. You know, this is an opportunity to collect data. Of course I'm interested. And luckily I was able to figure out how to work that into my workload. Myself and other people from my unit, Source Water Protection, did testing analysis and reports for the public water supply systems at Cromwell and Richfield. We took the data from the hydrogeology field camp for 2 years in July, in 2017, 2018, to take a look at that and did a preliminary analysis. Had some input to what was going to go on at Olivia and the USGS actually collect that data. And my question, and my part of this, was very specific, which is, okay, given Hiltilla's heterogeneous methods to estimate the quantity and vertical flow over the unit area was leakage or scale dependent. We get traditional aquifer testing may provide a bulk estimate of leakage. Actually, if you ask the question, many people don't. How do those estimates of leakage compare just from obwells in the aquifer versus obwells in the till? That, to me, is an important question to answer. So why leakage matters? Well, basically because that's the source of water in layered systems. So by definition, if it's layered, it's leaky. And so therefore the water originates at some point by infiltration and then vertical movement. The Tice conceptual model assumes no leakage. So that's an issue. If you're really going to understand the system, you have to include a conceptual model that actually solves for leakage. What are the assumed sources of water from the usual suspects here? Tice is the change in storage, and that's a little delta sign there, only, and then there's the leakage. The actual constant head boundary in that system is out at radial distance at infinity. Degli, and that's the first publication of the steady state model, actually was a PhD dissertation in Dutch, so of course we didn't know about it until some other Dutch people wrote about it. His solution was a steady state, no change in storage by definition. There's no time in it. It's the source of water's leakage only, and there's the constant head boundary of the water table. So, well, that's great. That was back, you know, almost 100 years ago. It took us until 1955 for somebody to publish a solution that included the composite, what I call a composite, both the transient and the steady state types of functions, and that was Hontus Jacob in 1955. Their special little tweak on the assumptions was there's no change in storage in the aquitard, so that they're fudging it right there because that math is particularly difficult. And so Neumann Witherspoon did that difficult math, and they included accounting for both the change in storage within the aquifer system and the aquifer tart. However, you know, that's hard to do. And in particular, if your experimental design is a little off from what Neumann and Witherspoon described as the easiest way to do it, which is all your observation wells are at a radial distance rather than kind of in a grid, then manually it's really difficult to do. So basically you have to use OCTASolve or some other modeling tool to iterate and arrive at an appropriate solution. So for the rest of the discussion, pretty much I'm going to be talking about Hontus Jacob, because that's something you actually can do manually. And the equations are a little simpler. So the composite models of how an aquifer works that solve for leakage, they solve for three properties. Right? You have transmissivity, like the dimension of length squared over time. storativity of some shape or form, which is dimensionless, and then characteristic leakage factor, which has a dimensional length. Huh, well, that's not dimensionless. Maybe that's useful for something. And then where does characteristic leakage factor, where it's a mouthful, so I'm going to call it leakage factor from now on. How does that appear in the equations, and how is it used, and why is it important to talk about it? So I'm going to compare Tice and Hodges-Jacob. So the normal transmissivity, storativity, leakage factor, in terms of, you know, those are the equations from Tice. Storativity is unchanged, but transmissivity has a little change in it, where it includes this other dimensions parameter, R over L, which is, you know, R would be radial distance, and so then L has a length, so then that's dimensionless. Okay. So where does the aquifer properties, that describes the aquifer properties, but where is the aquitard described in that system? Where are the properties of the aquitard? How do you back that out? Well, that's in the leakage factor. So it's down here. That's K prime is vertical conductivity, and B prime is the thickness of the aquitard. So in terms of what is that I'm interested in this project, how do I back that out? Well, I have to know, to solve for the conductivity, I have to know the aquitard thickness, I have to know the transmissivity, I have to know the leakage factor, and I get out my algebra lightsaber, and I square both sides and flip things around, and boom, I get the bulk aquitard vertical conductivity is the thickness of the aquitard divided by the hydraulic resistance, which has these bizarre units of time, the inverse of time, right? So one divided by days in our measurement system. So that's great. But what I really wanted to bring home is that these properties are all interdependent. So in terms of in your basic groundwater hydrology class, they say, okay, if you have an aquifer test and you know it's a confined system and your storativity is 0.2, well, somebody's smoking dope, or you've got the wrong aquifer, right? Or perhaps that transmissivity number is wrong because it's associated with this other parameter that clearly is physically impossible, right? And the same thing on the small end of the range. So say, for instance, you have a 10 to the minus 11th storativity, that transmissivity that corresponds to that, you can't trust, right? Well, all three of these factors are interrelated. So, and they're in the equation. So you have to have transmissivity to calculate your storativity. You have to have your transmissivity to figure out what your leakage factor is. And then in return, the dimensionless parameters are all in the well function. So this is a mess. All right, how the heck do you figure this out? Well, you have to make a picture. So this is a classic kind of replot of the Tice well function, and with Hodges-Jacob on it. So time is getting bigger to the right, paying no attention to the units, and drawdown is getting bigger upwards, right? And you see that the Tice curve, you keep on pumping it, basically the drawdown keeps getting bigger with time, period. However, you know that the Tice curve is associated with the assumption of no leakage. Well, where does leakage come in, right? So the point of this plot is that at some point in time, if leakage exists in that system, that drawdown is going to level off. And it's going to have this kind of weird S shape on a semi-log plot, right? And then with the increasing degrees of leakage, so if you have at some radial distance, if you have more leakage, it's going to stabilize earlier in time, right? So, and if you know what your radial distance is, then you can figure out what your leakage factor actually is. So, well, what does that mean with real data? Okay, so this is from a test of a Jordan sandstone well in the Twin Cities, and I, you know, came up with a match there with a leaky type curve, and I get a transmissivity and storativity, and they're kind of okay. They're, you know, it's within the confined range. And I know that my radial distance is 100 feet, and I come up with a leakage factor of 1,430. Oh, that's nice. Okay. But what does that do for me? Well, let's just say, for instance, at this site, I know I've got data from the pumping well, I've got this op well, I've got another op well. Right? What happens if I take this data and I say, okay, is this is pumped for a day? What if I project that out to 10,000 minutes or 7 days? What does that look like? Well, that's the other Jacob paper. It's the steady state type curve, which actually is the Bessel function of the second kind zero order. All right. That function actually is versus the exponential integral, which is the basis of the Tice curve. This function actually is in Excel. You don't have to program anything. So play with it. You know, try figure it out. So here I have distance from the pump well, and drawdown is increasing, right, upwards. Right? That makes sense that my pump well is somewhere over here, and these are my ob wells. But there's some weird kind of features of this curve. One is that it's log linear within some distance of the pump well, and then it actually bends and diverges from the log linear shape, and it's asymptotic to the x-axis. In other words, drawdown never reaches zero. That's kind of weird. So, okay. If we put our, you know, this is an illustration of say, a distance drawdown plot. So if we put a pump well on there and the drawdowns of different ob wells, and I see that my intersection here is right about just a little bit bigger than where x equals 1, right, in this function, this weird math function, right? Well, where x equals 1, that's where the leakage factor is. Right? So the leakage factor is slightly smaller than the x-intercept on a distance drawdown plot. Okay, that's good. But what does this actually do for me for aquifer test analysis? Well, if I have three wells and I'm solving for transmissivity and storativity at three wells, I got six numbers that describe that system. Here, I've got three numbers at each well plus a distance drawdown plot. I've got double the info. I got 12 numbers to actually kind of tease apart what the heck is going on. So please consider using this more, right? You'll figure it out. Now, what does this curve, the Bessel function, actually tell us about the source of water to a well in a leaky system? Yet another dimensionless type curve. However, this one was published in 2011 by a guy, Zhao. One of my co-workers who had been a student of Dr. Strock gave me this plot. In 2007. So it's been around for a while. It's just that those math heads who think about leakage take a while to publish stuff like this. And what is it? What it is the portion of the pumping induced leakage. Now, the leakage here is, there's two different kinds of leakage. There's the ambient leakage, and then there's the pumping induced leakage. So this is the part that actually is radial symmetric around the well, right? And this is R over L distance, so this is like using that factor from the Andrews-Jacob type curve to make it dimensionless, but basically we're still talking about one leakage factor, 2, 3, 4 on out. Well, the source of the amount of pumping-induced recharge here at 1L is 40%, right? Where, for instance, was our x-axis intercept on that log plot? Well, it was about right about here. Two leakage factors out, distance out is 72%, blah, 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 on to infinity. I would say radius of influence as a term has a problem. Because we've always assumed in that term that that has something to do with the source of the water to the well. That's obviously patently incorrect. So therefore, I would volunteer that we call it something different. And we'll say that that place where drawdown equals zero on the log linear plot should be called radius of detection. And then this curve here shows where reliable drawdown measurements would be in terms of distance from the well. Those where the curve starts to diverge from the log-linear shape, you shouldn't use for the regression because it's going to give you an incorrect transmissivity. Here's our radius of detection point. Here's a far field effect. And out here, there's no way you can measure drawdown. It's not measurable. And this is from my experience of doing aquifer tests for decades. So what do we know about this leakage factor? Well, it's this one of three properties that together describe the aquifer and its hydrogeologic setting. It's this bizarre square root of this ratio, aquifer transmissivity divided by the aquitard hydraulic resistance. It's required to estimate the vertical conductivity of the aquitard. Okay. And it's slightly shorter than the x-axis intercept log linear distance drawdown plot where drawdown is equal zero. And then it's useful. You can estimate the radial distance of observable drawdown if you know what the leakage factor should be from other tests. And it's the radius from the well over which a given portion of that pumping will occur that recharges the aquifer. The distance doesn't change. It's a characteristic of the hydrogeologic system, regardless of the pumping rate. So the whole idea of, we're just going to try and affect get a better signal, by increasing the pumping rate. Well, that really doesn't describe the recharge area to that well. What that does is just changes your signal-to-noise ratio and how far away you can actually detect it. So there you go. All right. Leakage has been giving me a brain cramp for a long time. If you feel like you're in good company and you're making progress. So with that, I'll launch into the description of the four tests and how did I use the leakage factor in terms of trying to figure out my vertical conductivity. Right? So part of the problem with this being involved kind of at the tail end of this project was I didn't know whether or not you could actually get reliable signal in the till lob wells over the course of a typical 1 to 5 day aquifer test, constant day test, and then if how do I evaluate whether or not that signal is reliable? Well, it is the ob well response log linear over time was my first cut, and then if for the whole well nest, because we have multiple observation wells in this nest, is that response linear over the thickness of that till unit would be another indication. And then we know that there's variability in the till. We don't know whether it's weathered or fractured or whatever the heck is going on. I'd leave that to the other investigators. Is the response linear over the full or partial thickness? And then my general analysis process was, okay, I want to characterize the aquifer properties according to my normal procedure of Tice and Hodges-Jacob, and I want to verify the drawdown in the aquifer at the till nest because oftentimes there was not an ob well at the till nest for these things, and I have to estimate that. And then I estimate the effective thickness of the till to evaluate the reliability of the signal and then model the till lob well data with OctoSolve because that's the best tool I have at this point to use for the Neumann-Witherspoon solution. So The Cromwell location up in northeastern Minnesota, we've heard the Cromwell Till. So obviously this is perhaps a tight section. This was extraordinarily leaky site, so therefore they came into it knowing that, so they placed the wells fairly close to the pump well. So this is pump Cromwell 4, here's Cromwell 3. It was off for the duration of the testing up there when I was working on it. Great cooperation from the operator. He really went up and above and beyond to help us conduct these tests. Nest 2 was about 50 feet away. Nest 1 was 140 feet away. And this is more or less a cross-section. I've got water table aquifer. The aquitard is the sandy till that now I know to call the Cromwell Till, but before that, what do I know? I work in southeastern Minnesota. I don't have to deal with this stuff. And and then the aquifer. Now, the particular problem with the site was that we have the aquifer is 145 feet thick, and we've got a 40-foot screen over a small portion of that. So clearly, there's partial penetration effects, and probably the oil field people call it skin effects. I've got 4 till obwells, no obwell in the aquifer at that nest that's 50 feet away. And then I've got 1 obwell in the aquifer at the elevation of the pump well, and then 1 other obwell in the aquitard. So the question is, because Neumann-Witherspoon solution does not include any corrections for partial penetration or skin, I really have to work on kind of iteratively figuring out what is the drawdown at the base of the till top of the aquifer. And so I use this plot. Now, this, you can plot it any which way. I just decided to do it this way. From the perspective, here's the base of the till, and drawdown's getting bigger this way, and the thickness of the till above the aquifer is going this way. So this, at Cromwell site, this is the water table, and that had no deflection. It had a 0 drawdown. And then each of these other wells were at different depths, and these are the drawdowns. The black dots were the observed drawdowns, and then if I projected that, those observed drawdowns out 10,000 minutes, and I do a linear regression, and I come up with a variety of numbers. The problem was I couldn't figure out which one of these numbers was correct. And the only way for me to figure it out was to plug it into OctaSolve and kind of iteratively solve it. Because OctaSolve has the corrections for partial penetration. And OctaSolve came up with a vertical anisotropy of 0.5 and these values for the aquifer. Now, that meant that the T transmissivity at the top of the aquifer should be about half that. So that's what was my target. And glory be, the Neumann-Witherspoon and OctaSolve iterated down to what the aquifer should be, quote unquote, and it's very close. And my manual analysis here, I knew it was very leaky, but these numbers are some of the leakiest, the smallest leakage factors I'd ever seen, because I'm usually not working in this type of environment. This is the vertical hydraulic connectivities I got from that. So this is the bulk vertical hydraulic connectivity from the aquifer response, and then these are from the response of the till obwells. And this is not weighted to anything. I did not use the obwell in the aquifer for any of these simulations. This simulation matched that 5.3 feet drawdown at the top of the aquifer quite nicely. So, what does this tell us? Well, this was the bulk from the nest one, and then one of the obwells in nest one and the till obwell in nest two had a similar trend. So I modeled those separately and I came up with 2 different values. and the geometric mean is about 2.2, and the bulk hydraulic conductivity is a little bit above that, which to me makes sense because this is pretty, one, it's a leaky setting, it's really close to a regional discharge. It makes sense to me that it would be biased to the high side. So, Litchfield location. Here's the pump well was Litchfield 2. This is the southernmost well in their well field. These green dots are the other wells, and they were off during the pumping test. This is the Nest 2 and Nest 1. They're about equidistant. Nest 1 is actually in the developed part of town, and I would note that there's a little creek that runs through here. So this was a drainage way that, you know, was active during, you know, when the glaciers melted out from this area. This is the more or less the setting. We've got water table, aquitard, and aquifer. The little variability in the thickness of the aquitard, and as I said, it was 100 to 110 feet of aquifer. And it's, with apologies to previous speakers, I'm calling it a clay till. And at least I'm not using the term overburden. That's for me, my perspective as well. What is this acting like to me? It's like acting like clay. Nest 2, we had some real problems with actually doing the test in this system. The water operator was very protective of his job, as he should be. The demands for water in this community were such that he really could not afford to turn it off and let it rest, and or for very long. And he also could not he had limited storage capacity. So, okay, the best I could do after lengthy negotiations was to get 6 hours of pumping, 10 hours of recovery. And for that, we saw no response in Nest 1 and Nest 2, and it didn't respond to pumping in Nest 1. I got, you know, manual assessment of the aquifer properties. I already knew what they were because I'd already done a pumping test in the 90s on the system, but it was pretty much as expected. You can see that when with the assumption of no leakage, I get a little higher T, and if I include the effect of leakage, well, then with a different conceptual model, I get a slightly smaller T and a leakage factor of 24,000 feet. Well, that's a little bit different than 500 feet. Yeah, well, this is a whole different setting. My bulk hydraulic conductivity is 0.0018, thinking that, okay, that's over that 113 feet of thickness of till. Unfortunately, my response in the till obwells is not linear. Okay. Maybe we're done here. This is the best I can get out of this system. But what happened was that when I was getting ready to go out to pull the equipment about July 1st, I had some personal issues. I couldn't make it out there until July 10th. And by the time I got out there, the bottom had dropped out of the aquifer. And all wells in the aquifer, all obwells in the aquifer had declined 8 to 10 feet in groundwater elevation. Huh. If I put that in, I get a linear response. But I have no idea where that effect is coming from. So I went back and I talked to USGS and I'm scratching our heads. And they pulled up the previous year's data, 2016. This is the daily variation in that well field, groundwater elevation. You can see that it's pretty stable and a band. 10-foot or so band. But in the summertime, three times, it dropped precipitously. And if I blow that up, you can see that it draws down and bounces back. And then if I plot precipitation events on that, well, that's a pretty good correlation. Two of those precipitation events are exactly lined up with rebounds in the groundwater relation. So my contention is that's the impact of regional groundwater irrigation pumping. And I know for certain that it was not the nearest irrigation well because I had a transducer in that well with the cooperation of the irrigator and DNR. So I know it's regional. That well was 3,000 plus feet away from the pump well. So it has to be beyond that. So if I know the rock properties, I know the effect that it has on the obwells in the aquifer of 8 to 9 feet of drawdown, I can model the impact of that in Aquasolve, and bingo, I got a very nice result. So that one pulled the iron out of the fire. And here, this was my manual result. The rest of these were all done with that effective thickness of the till of 48 feet, because it appears that there's absolutely no drop in head across that thickness of till down to 48 feet. So that kind of worked out just by hook or crook. Hydrogeology field camp location up in a sandier portion of till. This site was a little, the geometries were a little cramped because of access. They didn't want to cut down too many trees in this wooded setting, and so they plunked the obwells very, very close to the pump well. And I have two obwells in the aquifer, 50 feet away and 555 feet away. So I've got good data. This is a blow up of the distances between this area. And so I have a schematic cross section where I actually have separated these so you can actually see the completions rather than sitting on top of one another. And you can see that you've got these various till obwells going down, and here's our aquifer. It's very thin. Overall thickness of the tills variable, but in that area it's about 130 feet thick. But of interest, the pumping well had no recovery for about 10 feet when it was drilled. And I'm interpreting that as being a sand layer, which Bob and Scott said, yeah, that's probably right. So I think there's a local heterogeneity within the till layer and which was not encountered at either the nearby obwell in the aquifer or any of the deeper till obwells. So it is truly as limited extent. This is my effective thickness of the till. 2 points make a line, and then I estimated this from the drawdown in the aquifer. And so 3 points of certainty, and there you go. I think that actually has a strong effect on what was going on. And very, very low drawdown, small amounts, hundreds of feet, in drawdown in the upper elements. And we're probably running out of time.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I knew it. Okay, so these results are very, very consistent. They look good. Olivia, we got another situation. We got the obwell nest. Basically, here's groundwater elevation. Here's pumping in the aquifer, the pumping rate. This is the aquifer response. And here's in the aquitard, we have a vertical gradient over a very short distance of 70 feet. And if I look at the aquifer obwell response versus pumping, that looks pretty normal. However, this is a complete geek out. The till obwell response was reversed. So these are reverse water level fluctuations in till. Some people like to call that Nordbergen effect or some other weird thing. I prefer poroelastic responses. It's when you have something that's incompressible with high permeability that's right up against something that's elastic and low permeability, you get these kinds of weird pore pressure things going on. So, in other words, Olivia was not amenable to what I do. And the actual distance drawdown plot gives me one value that is nonsensical. It gave me 7,000, 8,000 feet squared per day and a nonsensical sortivity and leakage factor. That leakage factor is over one and a half times around the Earth. So that's not happening. So in other words, don't trust that number. And then these would be, down here would be my simulation, and these would be roughly the maximum vertical conductivity. So these are what I get out of the four sites, and a variety of different apparent vertical conductivities. And two of them had to adjust the effective thickness of the till. In terms of conclusions here, the test methods, I have the bulk K from the aquifer response and the local K from the till-obwell response. And because of the heterogeneity, the bulk K is biased to the high value where I have large-scale heterogeneity in the till. The one place where that did not show up unexpectedly was the hydrophil camp, which was really quite tight in terms of the range of values, which is interesting. And the Libya was basically a null result because I can't deal with that. And the general conclusions is that they're strongly influenced by most highly conductive till, which kind of makes sense. Where the obwells showed a response, I got comparable results from the nests, Witherspoon, Feynman Witherspoon, and the other techniques, sulfur leakage. The range of vertical conductivity was plus or minus 0.5 in terms of, the typical variation of what I see in aquifer tests. And lithology matters. We got all kinds of questions and implications here. How do we protect drinking water from contamination with focus recharge? We need more information about aquitards, obviously. And I go back to the mappers to start focusing my efforts on gathering more data.